This is Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. Join me, my husband Mark of Real Clear Investigations, 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, Aaron Wren of The American Conservative, and others for the 2024 Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, July 12th and 13th in Chicago. issuesetc.org.
It sounds like science fiction, but it isn't. The concept of an artificial womb. Now, you might think that might be a good thing medically to have the ability to have an artificial womb. Well, there are people out there in the fertility industry who think it's a great idea, but not because they think it will be any better for the children. How would such a device, an artificial womb, further harm the rights of children? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to discuss artificial wombs, Katie Faust. She's a married mother of four children in Seattle, founder and director of the children's rights organization Them Before Us. She's co-author of the new book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, Teaching Historical, Economic, and Biological Truth in a World of Lies, and a recent column for Public Discourse titled, Artificial Wombs Will Compound the Harm Reproductive Tech Inflicts on Children. Katie, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me again.
To kind of set the context here, tell us about your first visit to a Chinese orphanage.
Well, before I was a mom, soon after I was out of college, I worked for a Chinese adoption agency. I speak Chinese, and so one of my duties at the adoption agency was to translate the health reports and schedules of the kids, and they were always very, very regimented. So when I went to my very first orphanage, when I was accompanying a traveling group of families who were going to adopt their children, I walked into a room that was totally quiet. There was maybe 100 to 120 infants ages 3 to 6 months old who were in cribs, usually 2 to 3 per crib, head to toe. And I kind of walked through these columns of babies, and none of them were crying, but they were all awake. And I just thought, wow, I mean, that's the power of really regimented schedule. And so I leaned down and I picked up one of these babies, and she was amazing. She started out kind of listless and not really making eye contact, but I just started to sort of rock and sway and looking her in the eye. And, you know, within a few minutes, she came alive. You know, she was looking at me and she was cooing and starting to mimic some of the words that I was saying as I was mimicking back the sounds that she was making. It was just amazing for a woman who wasn't a mother yet to be able to hold this beautiful child. And then I thought, okay, you know, I've been holding her for 5 or 10 minutes. I'm going to set her down and I'm going to love another baby, love on another child. And I set her down right back where she was before, and she lost it. She wailed and screamed so loud, and it startled me, and I picked her back up again, and it slowly dawned on me. These children were quiet, not because they were on a regimented schedule, but because nobody came anymore. They had been starved of the maternal love, the parental love that every child needs. And so they had simply turned off their crying impulse and were laying dormant. And it stunned me. I didn't hold another baby the entire time. I just held her for an hour and a half. And then when I finally had to leave, I put her down and I ran because I couldn't handle the thought of her wailing after I left.
So I want to come back to that a little bit later. Are artificial wombs, are they science fiction?
Well, that is why I opened with that orphanage story, because those children, they grew up in a mother's womb. They were very likely, almost all of them, abandoned immediately. And even after 3 to 6 months of deprivation, they had kind of lost what it meant to be human in some ways in terms of emotional connection and responsiveness. So now we are talking about a whole new level of mother deprivation, human deprivation, and that is the advent of artificial wombs, which, even though they don't exist yet, there has been some beta testing done on premature lambs, and they have largely been successful. There was a video that made its way around the internet last year of like Ecto Labs, where it kind of showed this matrix style industrial scale baby manufacturing center of children gestating in pods, and that doesn't exist yet. But you do have places that are working towards it. China is looking at artificial wombs, hoping and working towards that technology. They're already developing what they call robot nannies, which can, if the artificial womb technology manifests itself, they can adjust the oxygen level, the nutrition level. They can rate which children are thriving and which ones need to have their oxygen and their food terminated because they no longer want those children. And so it is still not a reality, but it is coming, and there are different industries and countries that are really pushing for it.
What problems are artificial wombs supposed to solve?
Well, I cite in the article a variety of different voices who think that this is going to be a great idea. I think the most legitimate is the thought that sometimes babies need another enveloped place to develop fully if their mother is experiencing some kind of pregnancy challenge where she can't carry the child anymore, a cancer diagnosis or preeclampsia or something like that, where normally the baby would need to be delivered extremely prematurely. So the hope is that you could transfer those preemies into an artificial womb or a bio bag or something like that so that the child can develop longer and avoid a lot of the medical pitfalls that premature babies often face. So that's probably the one that we might be the most sympathetic to. But there's a lot of other people who think that this is going to be the great equalizer in terms of pregnancy and fertility because, you know, some people are discriminated against because they don't have a womb in their own body or a womb in their coupling or their thrupling. And so this is going to be something that's going to kind of make sure that everybody has equal access to children and childbearing. There's some people that think, hey, this is a working woman's dream. She no longer has to take off work to do the labor intense work of gestating a child for 9.5 months. You have some people that think, well, this is going to solve the abortion debate because now if somebody doesn't want a baby that is pregnant, they can just transfer them to an artificial womb and then the baby's life is preserved and the person doesn't have to be pregnant anymore. So there's a variety of different people who are looking forward to this technology with hope and enthusiasm. I am not one of them.
Why does Big Fertility want artificial wombs?
Well, what you're seeing right now in the massively unregulated, dangerous, commodifying fertility industry is really you need three components to assemble a baby. You need sperm, which is very, very easy to access and fairly cheap to acquire. You need eggs, which are much harder to access and much more expensive. And you need a womb. And the womb is probably the most elusive of the three of all. It's easy, and you know, sperm is in abundant supply. Eggs, we're now starting to be a little more savvy in terms of how we extract multiple eggs from different women, so you can find those too. But it's hard to find a woman who is going to give up her body for 9.5 months. And then if you do, it's very, very expensive. And so finding the womb is the hardest part of the baby assembly process. And if Big Fertility had a way to cut out the womb altogether, so they didn't have to find a real life woman to participate in gestation, not only would they save a lot of money, they'd be able to manufacture a lot more babies. And the other point is that a lot of times that womb, that woman, that surrogate, even if she's not genetically related to the child, she often is the only voice, the only person, the only advocate that the child has if, for example, the commissioning parents want an abortion or are unhappy with the product that they ordered because it was the wrong sex or it didn't developmentally form the way that they wanted to or there was too many of those children. Oftentimes that woman stands in the way of what Big Fertility is seeking, which is this perfect designer child and the child's fundamental right to life. So women can be very problematic when it comes to the baby assembly process. And if we could just eliminate them in terms of that finding a machine to be the womb instead of a real life woman, that would drop costs and cut out a lot of problems.
So you just hinted at this a few moments ago, but who else wants artificial wombs and why?
Well, the thing about detaching children from maternity, from their own mother, is it is much easier to then acquire children for purposes that may not be so noble. So in the surrogacy industry, we already have, unfortunately, a variety of very sickening, very disturbing cases of child predators who have acquired children through these technologies, through purchasing or renting the womb of a surrogate. I wrote about that at The Federalist a couple months ago, about five child predators who acquired children through surrogacy. And because this is an industry, this is a business, none of these people are going through like background checks. None of them are getting screened. None of them are known by social workers. Nobody's tracking where these children are going. So we already have child predators who are using surrogacy to acquire children that they're not intending to love as a father or mother would. Artificial wombs will simply compound that. I mean, you're further distancing the creation and the gestation of a child from the people who are most likely to cherish and care for them, their own mother and father. You're now subjecting them to processes where there may be no or very little human connection or oversight or knowledge of the child at all. And so this is a trafficker's dream. You know, normally if somebody wants to acquire a child, they need to snatch them, kidnap them, or purchase them, pay for them. And this is going to really eliminate most of the barriers that traffickers have used to acquire their victims. So this is something that is extremely dangerous. And we're really talking about dangers never before faced by human children.
You say that we have already been tinkering technologically with children for decades. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you can go way, way back to the birth control pill, which technologically severed sex from babies. And once we figured out how to separate sex from babies, we quickly figured out how to separate babies from sex through IVF, through in vitro fertilization, making babies in vitro, in glass, instead of in the sexual embrace of their parents. And once we figured out how to make babies in glass, it was much easier to make babies that involved third parties, somebody else's sperm, somebody else's egg, and now, of course, somebody else's womb. And we've moved on to the not just making babies in glass and implanting them in their own mothers. Now we're looking at catalogs or women or factories overseas of brown women who can gestate your child for you. And every new step of this technological tinkering that we've done with children as related to their conception and their birth, it has not gone well. I mean, we can look at studies of children who were simply separated from a genetic father through sperm donation, who was still raised by their biological mother, the woman who gave birth to them, and raised in the home of a social father with a man who loved them, who they had the paternal love in their home. And yet, even those kids, just simply missing the biological link to their own genetic father, they don't fare as well. And so now, you know, every step that you take to remove the child from one more connection with their birth father, with their birth mother, with the natural union that happens between husband and wife, we just see that outcomes decline for kids. And now we're talking about taking this dystopic step of separating children from a real life woman at the moment of birth and all the way from conception to birth. It's not going to end well.
How has big fertility, just go into a little more detail, how big fertility has introduced third parties into the process?
Well, again, a lot of times the customers that big fertility is seeking to serve do not have their own sperm or egg or womb to supply to the baby assembly process. And so they need to outsource, they need to purchase the genetic father, the genetic mother, the birth mother for the child to satisfy their customer base. And so we often at Them Before Us contrast big fertility with adoption. You know, adoption is an institution centered around the well-being of children. Big fertility is a marketplace centered around the desire of adults. In adoption, adults who are bringing these children into their home are seeking to mend a wound, a familial wound that was inflicted on the child when their birth parents couldn't or wouldn't raise them. In big fertility, you're inflicting the wound on the child by purposefully separating them from their genetic mother, genetic father, or their birth mother. And so the introduction of third parties is routine in big fertility because very often they need to satisfy the desires of their single parent customers, their same-sex parent customers, those women maybe who don't want to ruin their bikini body, and so they'd like a surrogate instead of gestating the child on their own. So in contrast to adoption, where the child is the client and their best interest reigns supreme, the client in big fertility is the adults. And very often these adults have desires or arrangements that require the use of a third party, somebody else's sperm, egg, or womb. And big fertility has no qualms about that, because for them, it really is just all about the profit.
Katie Faust is our guest. She's founder and director of the children's rights organization, Them Before Us. We're talking about artificial wombs. We'll discuss donor children a little bit more after this.
So if you think that, you know, you still live in a country where there's going to be some respect for your beliefs, you know, you could end up, you know, on the wrong end of a criminal prosecution.
Aaron Wren of the American Conservative talking about his presentation at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And so that might be, of course, unfair or in many ways, but it's also reality. If you don't understand the changes that have happened in the world, then you're not going to be able to make sense of what you see around you. And again, you might actually disadvantage yourself by taking actions that 20, 30 years ago would have been no big deal, but today might destroy your life.
You can meet and hear Aaron Wren making the case for Christianity in a negative world at this year's Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. You'll find additional information, and you can register at issuesetc.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Pastor Matthew Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The LCMS operates the second largest parochial school system in the United States. What can you expect from a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod school? There's one race, the human race. And Jesus died for the sins of every man, woman, and child from every land and every nation. Life begins at conception. All life is precious from womb to tomb. And every student, parent, and teacher is created in the very image of God. There's right and wrong, and we know which is which from the Ten Commandments. There are only two sexes, male and female. He created them. Marriage is the lifelong union of one man and one woman. There's such a thing as objective, absolute truth, and it's found in the person and work of Jesus Christ and His Word. To find a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod school near you, visit lcms.org/schools.
Thanks to James and Beth in St. Paul, Minnesota, Anastasia in Alexandria, Virginia, and JG and Susan in Champaign, Illinois, for recently registering for the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th, Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. You can meet and hear 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway, Aaron Wren of the American Conservative, and pastors Brian Wolfmiller, Will Whedon, and Chris Rosebrough. Find out more at issuesetc.org or by giving us a call, 618-223-8385, Making the Case, July 12th and 13th in Collinsville, Illinois. We're discussing artificial wombs with Katie Faust, director of the children's rights organization, Them Before Us. Katie, what more do we know about donor children?
Well, it is much closer of a separation from the natural reality than the gigantic leap that artificial wombs would be from the needs of children when it comes to conception and gestation. But even these kids, they struggle. So we don't have tons and tons of data. I mean, we should. I mean, we've been making children in laboratories for the last several decades. And while we do have pretty significant information on the fact that IVF children do struggle, do suffer, do have more medical harms than children that are naturally born, especially as it relates to developmental disabilities, premature birth, increased cancer risk. When it comes to surveying children created through somebody else's sperm and somebody else's egg, we don't have as much information on that, even though most of them were created through IVF and are going to suffer the same kind of developmental or preterm birth risks that the IVF children suffer. But we do have a few studies that talk about how these children that are created from somebody else's sperm or somebody else's egg suffer. And one of the primary ways that they suffer is in relation to identity formation. Many of them struggle to answer the question, who am I? Because they don't know how to answer the question, whose am I? If you are severed from your own mother or father by reproductive technologies or otherwise, it is very, very hard for children to stably form an identity. And so we do see that in the few studies that we have of children created through sperm and egg donors. Many of them struggle with feelings of commodification, as if they were a designer product, because they were a designer product. Many of them are concerned about the similarities of their conception to eugenic practices, because what takes place in big fertility is eugenic practices. There's all kinds of pre-implantation screenings that take place to weed out the undesirables. There's often sex selection that takes place to decide, do I want a boy or a girl, or that boy or that girl? And so it is a filtering of human beings that looks an awful lot like eugenics. And then, of course, these kids struggle with longing to know their own biological mother or father that commercially sold them to an industry that violated their rights. So even the more mild tools that we have used to separate children from their mother or father has inflicted damage and harm to kids. So you can then speculate that if you take this massive leap away from sort of the natural ways that children come to being through gestating them in an artificial womb, honestly, I don't even know if these children are going to survive. I mean, what we're about to attempt on these kids, if the artificial womb technology manifests itself, I don't know. I mean, we're really starving them of the fundamentals of what it means to be human.
Talk about the mother-child bond that is formed in the womb.
Well, it's interesting because I was just on Twitter this morning talking about a reel that somebody shared of a woman who was pregnant with her own child, but she also had a surrogate. So she was going to give birth to her baby, and 6 weeks later, she was going to fly to Mexico or something and pick up her surrogate-born baby. And I talked about how I also met a woman who was in that exact situation, nearly exact situation, a couple years ago. They thought they were infertile. They created a biological child, and they rented the womb of another woman and created a surrogate-born baby. But a month or two later, she was pregnant. And so the baby of the surrogate was born first, but born premature, because very often these children are, and spent several weeks in the NICU. And that whole time, you know, the mother didn't feel connected to that baby. And instead, she was feeling very bonded to the baby that she was gestating and carrying herself. And then she gave birth, and she already had her surrogate-born baby home, but then she gave birth to the baby she carried naturally. And both of these children were genetically connected to and related to her. But, I mean, she told me she had almost an aversion to the child. She didn't carry herself, but she felt so enraptured and in love with the baby that she had carried. Because guess what? Mothers and babies bond through the process of pregnancy. And if a woman feels that way about the baby that she is carrying, which very, very often she does, even surrogate mothers report very often feel strong love and connection to the children they're carrying. Very often, like I said, are the only thing that stands between that baby's life and death. If the commissioning parents that don't have that kind of bond are unhappy with the process or want to terminate the pregnancy, if that woman feels so connected to the baby and she has dozens or hundreds of other relationships, how bonded do you think the baby is to the surrogate? And that is to a degree that it's very hard to describe in English. They are, from the baby's perspective, one and the same. And to lose that one woman inflicts what we at Them Before Us call a primal wound. So this fact that women and babies bond during pregnancy, it's not something that anybody would have disputed until we had surrogacy apologists trying to normalize and minimalize the fact that this is one of the most fundamental human bonds that any of us can form.
What other dangers does cutting the mother out of the gestational process pose for the children?
Well, massive dehumanization, of course, I think that the biggest threat is going to be traffickers. I mean, you will be able to set up factories of children that you're growing, you know, without anybody knowing that these little humans exist, with no birth certificates, separated, disconnected from their biological parents, who they were just purchased, you know, you can just purchase gametes on the open market or on the black market, which I'm sure there'll be a development of as well. I mean, I don't know. It's dystopic. It's egregious. You know, the possibilities of creating children outside of the presence of a human mother, it simply means that these are going to be the most vulnerable and therefore the most victimized population of children that we have ever seen or ever known. So it's very important. I think a lot of us hear about artificial wombs and it surprises us and it shocks us, and it should. But the reality is that we've got to get very, very straight reproductive technologies now, because artificial wombs are going to bust on the scene and everyone's going to think it's so great, unless we first understand that we need to stand against the current reproductive technologies as they are now. We need clarity now on reproductive technologies that are already victimizing children and violating their rights, so that when artificial wombs hit the headlines, we have an unequivocal stance against them on the basis of child protection.
What final warning would you give about the future of artificial wombs?
Well, simply that just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should do something. And I feel like this is a lesson that we learn over and over and over with technology, especially in the area of reproductive technologies. The technology is outpacing any kind of ethical conversation that we can have. And honestly, the church should be the one that is speaking the most clearly and the most courageously against it. And yet I don't hear very many sermons being preached on surrogacy and reproductive technologies, let alone IVF, which the reality is a huge portion of people in the congregation are probably using, or at least know somebody who has used. And so we will not be able to get this straight unless Christians get it straight. And Christians are not going to be able to get it straight until they understand that one of the primary manifestations of their relationship with Christ is child protection. And thank God that we're not dealing with a lot of the horrifying examples of child exploitation and abuse that they were during the first century, even though some of those are coming back. We now have new threats to children, new dystopic technological threats to children. And we, the church, need to do what we have always done, which is prioritize the least of these, stand up for those rights, and defend them. We just need to. It's just taken us so long to figure out that actually child protection is going to look a little different in the 21st century than it did in the first century. So get it straight, get it right. You've got to start speaking out, be educated about it, because the lives of very real children depend on it.
Katie Faust is a married mother of four children in Seattle, founder and director of the children's rights organization Them Before Us. She's co-author of the new book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, Teaching Historical, Economic, and Biological Truth in a World of Lies, and a recent column for Public Discourse titled Artificial Wombs Will Compound the Harm Reproductive Tech Inflicts on Children. You'll find a link to this column and to Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Katie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, Lyman Stone will join us, a research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, to discuss American women's attitudes about fertility and contraception.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is a collection of more than 600 hand-drawn Christian symbols by artist and author Edward Riojas. It's titled A Complete Guide to Christian Symbols. This new resource is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about a complete guide to Christian symbols at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, a complete guide to Christian symbols.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Hope for Healing, April 19th and 20th in Irvine, California, is a conference designed to address the issue of gender brokenness and more. Hope for Healing is for high school and college youth, as well as adults. Join Y for Life and Lutherans for Life to find out what makes your body a good gift and what happens when gender is disordered. Learn more and register at yforlife.org. Hope for Healing, April 19th and 20th in Irvine, California. Y4life.org.
Memoria Press is a worldwide leader in the publishing of classical Christian education. We have everything you need for students in kindergarten through 12th grade, and our materials can be used in any classroom setting to suit your needs. If you're interested in learning more, visit them at memoriapress.com and use the coupon code LPR24 to save $5 at checkout. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.